content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the August 28, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Clinton's email problems worrying Democrats. What happened? Hillary Clinton was forced to issue assurances to key supporters and donors that her presidential campaign was not in danger this week amid a widening federal investigation into the private email server she used as Secretary of State. Intelligence officials took possession of the server and three thumb drives as they revealed that hundreds of classified emails may have passed through Clinton's private address. Her lawyer said this server had been wiped of all records, and it was unclear whether the FBI could recover the data. As questions about Clinton's honesty swirled, the Democratic frontrunner's favorability ratings slumped to their lowest level since 2001, with 53% of the public holding an unfavorable view of her. Polls show that Clinton was now actually trailing rival Bernie Sanders in New Hampshire, and that her head-to-head advantage over top-tier Republican candidates was shrinking. Her slump fueled speculation that Vice President Joe Biden, or even 2000 Democratic nominee Al Gore, could jump into the campaign to give Democrats an alternative. Clinton continued to deny any wrongdoing, saying her opponents were engaged in the usual politicization when she handed over 30,000 emails to the State Department for review in March. Having deleted a similar number she said were personal, the former First Lady insisted that they contained no classified material. Clinton turned over the server to the Justice Department when a preliminary investigation disclosed that some of the emails it had received contained classified information. This week, the State Department revealed that at least another 305 emails may also have contained classified material. Asked by reporters if the email story was hurting her campaign, Clinton shrugged and replied, "Nobody talks to me about it other than you guys." What the editorial said. The revelations and questions keep coming, said the Wall Street Journal. Clinton had no business using private email for sensitive official documents, and experts say that it's a virtual certainty that the private server was accessed by private hackers or foreign intelligence services. Clinton knew the rules and the risks, but broke them anyway to keep control over the emails. This is gross negligence in the pursuit of self-interest. Clinton has compounded her original error with an overly controlling response to inquiries about her emails, said the Los Angeles Times. But it's actually not uncommon for documents handled by public officials to be classified retroactively, especially when the information is being publicly released. Nevertheless, using a private server was bad policy and bad politics. What the columnist said. The Clinton ship is taking on water, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. President Obama probably still sees her as his best bet to preserve his legacy, so his Justice Department is unlikely to charge her with any crime. But her top aides just sent out a 700-word, "Everyone Remain Calm" memo to top supporters and blamed the server scandal on a partisan witch hunt, which tells you they're panicking. If that server contains incriminating emails proving that foreign donors to the Clinton Foundation got favors from the Secretary of State, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com, Hillary will be finished. Time for a reality check, said Nate Silver in 538.com. The server problem will probably fade in the coming months. And my calculations show that Clinton still has an 85% chance of winning the Democratic nomination. Negative press coverage for the front runner at this stage of a presidential campaign is par for the course, especially for one named Clinton. Favorability ratings mean very little this early, and the potential Democratic alternatives all have serious flaws. Clinton remains the heavy favorite. "Still, I just wish she'd apologize," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Clinton used a private server in her basement because she wanted control over her official communications, which actually belonged to the public. Rather than insulting our intelligence by stonewalling, Clinton should just admit, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." This slow-burning scandal probably won't cost her the nomination, but the growing damage to her credibility could very well hurt her in the general election. Clinton is her own worst enemy. And a second main story this week, Trump's explosive immigration plan. What happened? Donald Trump moved to solidify his lead in the Republican presidential race last week by unveiling an immigration plan that calls for all 11.5 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. to be deported and an end to automatic citizenship for U.S.-born children of illegal immigrants. Trump would also erect a wall along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexican border and vowed to make Mexico pay for it. He advocates new restrictions on visas for high-skilled workers and would make it far more difficult to seek asylum, requiring refugees to certify that they can pay for housing and health care before coming to the U.S. The billionaire businessman and TV personality framed his plan as a way to protect American jobs. "Decades of disastrous trade deals and immigration policies have destroyed our middle class," Trump said. Trump's manifesto divided his GOP rivals. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker endorsed ending birthright citizenship, which would likely require altering the Constitution's 14th Amendment. But Florida Senator Marco Rubio said Trump's proposals could never pass Congress. And former Florida Governor Jeb Bush blasted the plan as not grounded in reality. The latest CNN/ORC poll found Trump leading the second-place Bush by 24% to 13% nationally among Republican voters. Trump now ties Walker as the most competitive GOP candidate against Democrat Hillary Clinton in a general election, trailing the former Secretary of State by 6 points, 45% to 51%. What the editorial said. "Welcome to Trumpistan," said the New York Daily News. "This plan reveals just how callous, unworkable, and economically catastrophic a Trump presidency would be. His mass deportation scheme, which analysts say could cost $200 billion, would turn the U.S. into an East German-style police state where anyone might turn informant. Trump's call for a pause on issuing green cards would curtail legal immigration, something that has only enriched the nation. The billionaire's campaign slogan might be Make America Great Again, but his policies would turn the country into a stagnant, fearful shadow of its former self. Trump's immigration platform is flawed, but it is sensible in its basic outline," said NationalReview.com. "His core principles, controlling the border, enforcing immigration laws, and putting U.S. workers first, should be the starting point of any reasonable immigration policy. Of course, some proposals are unrealistic. Punishing Mexico by making it pay for our border wall, for example, is absurd. What the GOP field should do now is take up Trump's principles and supplement them with a fuller range of sensible policies." What the columnist said. "It's even crueler than I expected," said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. "Consider Trump's mass deportation scheme, which contrives to force people from the country by making their families suffer. How? Unauthorized immigrants would be banned from receiving tax credits for their U.S.-born kids, and the money they send to poor relatives back home would be confiscated. Pundits may regard Trump as a joke, But you can bet every other GOP candidate is scrambling to appeal to voters who lap up those breathtakingly callous policies. That's because these proposals resonate not just with many Republican voters, but the nation at large, said Jay Cost in WeeklyStandard.com. Increasing enforcement, ensuring that employers hire Americans, these issues are stoking Trump's surge, and that should be a lesson to his GOP rivals. That is, if the stain of Trumpist nativism hasn't already doomed the party, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Rounding up dreamers, criminalizing newborns, all that's missing is a proposal to deport the Statue of Liberty back to her native France. Trump's xenophobia would likely have barred his own grandfather, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. The German-born Friedrich Drumpf arrived in the U.S. in 1885, just a few decades after America saw violent clashes between the nativist zealots of the Know-Nothing Party and European immigrants who, yes, competed with Americans for jobs. Know-Nothingism lost, which is why Drumpf was allowed in the country. Donald Trump, notwithstanding, this nation of immigrants will defeat its nativist elements again. The controversy of this week, also a political article. Sanders, could he actually beat Clinton? He may be the nutty Vermont uncle of Democratic politics, said Molly Ball in TheAtlantic.com, but Senator Bernie Sanders is on a roll. Hillary Clinton still holds a 35-point lead in national polls, but the gruff, wild-haired, self-described Democratic Socialist, 73, is beating her 44% to 37% in the early primary state of New Hampshire, and is drawing the largest crowds of any presidential candidate from either party, including 27,000 at a rally in Los Angeles. Why such excitement over this thoroughly implausible candidate? Bernie Sanders has one thing Hillary doesn't, an ideology. Socialism has long been a dirty word in U.S. politics, but Sanders' message of higher taxes on the rich, banking reform, a tax on carbon, free college tuition, campaign finance reform, and a true single-payer health care system is striking a chord with many liberals frustrated by the compromise and incrementalism of the Obama years. Media naysayers keep insisting Sanders can't win, said H.A. Goodman in HuffingtonPost.com. But now that voters are hearing what he has to say, they're realizing his views are mainstream. As Clinton struggles to fend off another scandal, Sanders is riding a wave of nationwide electricity and enthusiasm that might carry him to the Democratic nomination and ultimately to the White House. Dream on, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Sanders may have captured the hearts of coastal liberals and independents who had serious doubts about a Clinton restoration to begin with, but the party's mainstream is still squarely behind Hillary. The latest CBS News poll found Clinton with an 82% favorable rating among Democratic primary voters to Sanders' 37%. A new Gallup poll found that a dismal 23% of black voters view him favorably, compared with 80% for Hillary. For all the Bernie-mentum, these still look like numbers of a protest candidate rather than one capable of putting together a broad coalition. Sanders has a chance to beat Clinton in Iowa and New Hampshire, said David Beiler in RealClearPolitics.com. But unless he can broaden his appeal beyond white liberals, she'll destroy him in subsequent primaries in the South and Midwest. Still, Clinton can't afford to ignore Bernie Sanders any longer, said Julian Zelizer in CNN.com. His rise reminds Democrats of what their party has stood for since the New Deal: using government to assist the poor, grow the middle class, regulate big business, and build the nation's infrastructure. The longer Sanders stays in the race, the more likely it is that Clinton will incorporate some of his strategies into her own playbook. She needs to speak with less caution and more passion and lay out a vision of social and economic justice with urgency and without apology. That's wishful thinking, said former Democratic Congressman Barney Frank in Politico.com. If Clinton and Sanders get into a drawn-out primary battle in which he raises doubts about her progressive credentials, it will depress liberal turnout in the general election and perhaps hand the White House to the Republicans. But Sanders is too much of a true believer to back off, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. His surge may take him even higher in the polls, and his success against the wounded Clinton is inspiring some Democrats to urge Vice President Joe Biden and former Vice President Al Gore to jump into the race. Whether or not he wins the nomination, Sanders has already made a big difference. Clinton's coronation is off. Well, it was a good week for one-upmanship after two robbers demanded money from a Pittsburgh stone owner at knife point, only to flee when he whipped out a massive scimitar from under the counter. "I used this one," Jawad Hayat said of his sword, "to make him afraid." It was a good week for butt dialing after Sam Ray, 18, became trapped under his pickup truck when a jack collapsed. Luckily, the weight of the vehicle turned on his iPhone's voice-activated assistant, and he shouted, "Siri, dial 911, bringing rescuers." "I guess I'm stuck with an iPhone for the rest of my life," said Ray. And it was a good week for feedback after Yelp and the federal government announced an agreement in which air passengers can review their experience with TSA agents, and the TSA can respond. But it was a bad week for stashes after a New York City woman hid $5,600 in a toaster oven, and her husband returned the oven to the store. Store employees then told her someone else came in to claim the cash. It was a bad week for family feuds after a Kentucky man was arrested for allegedly attempting to dig up his dad's churchyard grave so the two could settle a father-son rift. "The overall circumstances are strange," conceded Greg Haynes, pastor of Pilot Baptist Church. And it was a bad week for lasting passion after a 71-year-old man was arrested for attacking Talladega, Alabama's 74-year-old mayor, Larry Barton, with a baseball bat, after allegedly catching Barton on a hidden camera having sex with the man's estranged wife. Said an attorney who viewed the Randy tape, "It gives me hope for me when I'm 70. We're on the briefing page now. Life under the caliphate. Up to 8 million people in Syria and northern Iraq are living under the brutal rule of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Is the Islamic State a state? It doesn't operate as one, despite the grand declaration of a new caliphate last summer by its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. In reality, its state in Syria and Iraq consists of several cities and many small towns and villages occupied by a large, brutal military force. On the battlefield, ISIS is quite competent, because it is led by a cadre of ex-Iraqi generals and veteran al-Qaeda commanders with deep military training and experience. But its civilian administration of the territory it has conquered is primitive, with a population strictly controlled through draconian laws, barbaric punishments, and fear. Kirk Sowell, a Middle East analyst and risk consultant, says ISIS operates like something between a mafia, an insurgency, and a terror group. How does it get money? Any way it can. ISIS's grand ambition, such as building its own currency, have yet to come about. People in its territory use Syrian pounds, Iraqi dinars, and U.S. dollars. ISIS's major challenge is paying and organizing its force of more than 30,000 fighters, operating across an area the size of Maryland. The group is said to make about $1 million a day through extortion, kidnapping, and selling crude oil from captured wells in Syria. It has also established some very basic bureaucracies and taxes. Trucks are charged 10% of their cargo's value when they enter ISIS-controlled regions. Businesses pay 2.5% tax on their revenue each year. If they don't take it, explains Mahmoud, a gas engineer in Syria, they tax you for it. What is daily life like? ISIS is devoted to restoring the earliest, purest form of Islam, as practiced under the Prophet Muhammad and his followers in the 7th century. So in cities such as Raqqa, ISIS's de facto capital in northern Syria, and Mosul in Iraq, morality police, called the Hizbah, patrol the streets, checking that shops are closed during prayers, men are bearded, and women are properly dressed. At checkpoints, the Hizbah inspect mobile phones for subversive text messages or Facebook entries, and ensure taxi drivers are listening to the official ISIS radio station. Former police officers, human rights activists, in fact anyone deemed heretical, must carry a repentance card to show allegiance to ISIS. Dozens of un-Islamic activities, smoking, listening to music, wearing hair gel, are punishable by floggings, amputation, or execution. ISIS has released video footage of gay men being thrown off tall buildings to their deaths. Jews and Christians are given a choice to convert or die. Executions and floggings happen almost daily in the streets and parks, sometimes with large crowds watching. One ISIS pamphlet from Aleppo lists punishments for crimes including drinking alcohol, 80 lashes, slander, 80 lashes, spying in the service of infidels, death, renunciation of Islam, death, robbery, if robbery and murder are committed, death by crucifixion. What are the rules for women? The severest and most degrading of all. Women in the Islamic State, an online manifesto written by female ISIS supporters, decrees that girls can marry at age 9 and should have husbands by 16 or 17. In certain ISIS-controlled regions, women must wear 2 black gowns to mask their body shape and 3 veils so their eyes cannot be seen, even in sunlight. Any woman caught unaccompanied by a male relative or breaching dress codes is detained and flogged by the Al-Qansa Brigade, a pervasive all-female militia. Those accused of adultery have been stoned to death. In Iraq, more than 1,300 women and children from the Yazidi community, a tiny religious minority, have been taken into sex slavery. A network of warehouses has been set up where the sex slaves, some as young as 12, are showcased like new cars, sold to ISIS fighters, and kept captive, the New York Times reported this week. Every time that he came to rape me, he would pray, one 15-year-old girl said of the fighter who owned her. He said that raping me was his prayer to God. How do people under its control feel about ISIS? People brave enough to speak out against the group say it's feared and loathed. But for the mostly Sunni population in its territory, the depressing truth is that the alternative, Bashar al-Assad's brutal Syrian regime, or Iraq's corrupt Shiite-dominated regime, aren't much better. Indeed, in the early days of its victories in 2013 and 2014, Sunnis largely welcomed ISIS. That's changing because living conditions are badly deteriorating. In some regions, gasoline cost as much as $18 a gallon. Prices of cooking gas, flour, bread, and other essentials have also soared. People are rationing water and burning wood amid shortages and power outages. Maybe ISIS thought 6 months ago they were going to function as a state, says Sowell, but they don't have the personnel or manpower. The critical question is whether any government in the chaotic region can do a better job. Take a look at the columns now. First, from the U.S., California's new attitude about water. California is weathering a drought with remarkable resilience, said Charles Fishman. After the driest four-year period in state history, Californians are aggressively reducing their use of water, recycling it, replacing grass lawns with desert landscaping, and learning to do more with less. Farmers are rapidly moving to drip or micro-irrigation that enables them to keep supplying half the nation's produce with far less water. Urban communities are succeeding in cutting water use to the point where a Southern California district is saving 1 billion gallons per day, as much as New York City uses in a day. Serious problems continue, of course, including raging wildfires and farmers overpumping of the aquifers. But the state's economy is doing fabulously, with 27% growth in 2014 and 462,000 jobs created over the past year, far more than any other state. Water supplies are becoming a problem in other parts of the country, so California is providing an important example. Californians now regard water as scarce and precious resource, and it's that attitude that will save the state and the rest of us as well. From the United Kingdom, is labor returning to socialism? The British Labour Party is rediscovering its leftist roots, said Owen Jones in The New Statesman. Labour's terminally awkward leader, Ed Miliband, resigned earlier this year after the party was trounced in national elections by the ruling centre-right Conservatives. And now the front-runner to replace him is an unreconstructed socialist, Jeremy Corbyn, 66, wants to nationalise the railways and energy companies, pull Britain out of NATO, limit what private landlords can charge for rent, and make college free for the poor. His radical program is a total repudiation of the centrist that has reigned since former Prime Minister Tony Blair reinvented the party as New Labour in the 1990s. The public is ready for that change. Polls show large majorities in favor of everything from hiking taxes on the rich to improving workers' rights to public ownership of utilities. The London elite and the media are appalled, and they are dripping condescension, smarm, contempt, or outright bile on Corbyn's supporters. But make no mistake, he has unleashed the biggest pan-British progressive grassroots political movement in many years. We conservatives are cackling with delight, said London Mayor Boris Johnson in the Daily Telegraph. If Labour picks Corbyn, they'll never win another election. He's a Sinn Féin loving, monarchy baiting, Israel bashing believer in unilateral nuclear disarmament who would take this country back to the 1970s or perhaps even the 1790s. He associates with noted anti-Semites. Why is he ahead? Partly because his three challengers are so robotically dull that they have made Jeremy's woolly rumination seem positively electrifying. But mostly it's because Labor's base really wants a Soviet-styled command economy. I feel vindicated. I told you they were loony. Please, Labor members, don't do this, said Tony Blair in The Guardian. The party is walking, eyes shut, arms outstretched, over the cliff's edge to the jagged rocks below, and someone must save it with a rugby tackle. A hard left agenda cannot prevail in today's Britain. It didn't even work decades ago, which is why the party was out of office from 1979 to 1997. If Corbyn is elected party leader, Labour will be doomed to shout impotently from opposition while the pro-austerity conservatives govern as they wish, and the British people will suffer. Don't you want to govern? What apocalyptic nonsense, said Mark Steele and the Independent. Not just Blair, but practically every prominent Labour figure has come out screeching against Corbyn, terrified of the prospect of a leader who stands for something. Yet Corbyn's vision of the future of the party, while the old guard rails and wrings its hands, tens of thousands of people are signing up to join Labour and support Corbyn. Loads of them are young and full of energy, and they're really enthusiastic. We may be about to witness a real revolution. And we turn now to our in-depth article for the week, The Last Word. This one titled, The Art of Movie Noise. Sounds in movies aren't always what they seem, said Jordan Kisner. Rain? It's actually sizzling bacon. Skip Leavesay, an unassuming-looking guy in his mid-60s with highly trained ears, stood before the stacks of speakers and giant movie screen in his office, fussing quietly. Leavesay is one of the preeminent sound designers working in film today, and whatever he does it quietly, as if his personal volume dial operated in inverse correlation to the often noisy task at hand. On this midwinter afternoon, he was meeting with one of his effects editors, a similarly soft-spoken young man named Larry Zipf, about a film they had been hired to work on, Miles Ahead, a forthcoming Miles Davis biopic directed by and starring Don Cheadle. The two men stood with their arms crossed and heads cocked at the same angle, reviewing a scene in which a sound cue they had designed had gone awry. The sound, originally of vintage tape decks turning, had ended up evoking a sci-fi odyssey rather than a jazz biopic. One of the problems, it was agreed, is that to the untrained ear, 1970s tape decks sound a bit like lasers. On screen, Cheadle entered an elevator and pushed the button for the lobby. The button emitted a soft, innocuous beep. That's a good beep, Lar. Leavesay muttered. Good beep. As he said so, Cheadle, as Miles, leaned against the wood-paneled elevator wall, eyes closed. Suddenly, the elevator swung open to reveal a dark room of Miles' imagination, filled only with a piano, a horn, and a spotlight. The moment was intended to feel surreal, as though you were entering Miles' mind. But as the door began to swing, a deep rumble erupted into a volley of zings and swishes, those troublesome tape decks, as if the scene had plunged into a battle in outer space. Leavesay hit pause and turned to Zipf, shaking his head. no good. For research, Livesay has spent a few months reading biographies and listening through all the recordings in the Miles Davis estate. The film is set in the 1970s, which is Bitches Brew Miles, Livesay explained, a period when Miles favored improvisational rhythms and electric instruments over traditional jazz. The research has led to the idea of experimenting with recording equipment of the sort that Miles would have used. They got their hands on some vintage tape decks and spent an afternoon recording the sound of them playing forward and backward, clicking and scrubbing. But when Zipf edited the sounds and played them underneath scenes from the movie, the result sounded like Battlestar Galactica, not old-fashioned music equipment. Livesay sighed. Probably because sound editors used to use tape decks when they needed space sounds. Bet you Battlestar Galactica was tape decks. He threw the noises out and started over. It is a central principle of sound editing that people hear what they are conditioned to hear, not what they are actually hearing. The sound of rain in movies? Frying bacon. Car engines revving in a chase scene? It's partly engines, but what gives it that visceral gut-level grind is lion roars mixed in. To be excellent, a sound editor needs not just a sharp, trained ear, but also a gift for imagining what a sound could do, what someone else might hear. Livesay is one of the best. He won an Academy Award in 2014 for his work on Gravity, Goodfellas, Silence of the Lambs, Do the Right Thing, his work. He is also the only sound editor the Coen brothers work with, which means that he is the person responsible for that gnarly wood chipper noise in Fargo, the peel of wallpaper in Barton Fink, the resonance of the dude's bowling ball in The Big Lebowski, and the absolutely chilling crinkle of Javier Bardem's gum wrapper in No Country for Old Men. Jonathan Demme, who first worked with Livesay on The Silence of the Lambs, put it concisely, he's a genius. Despite Livesay's influence, you have probably never heard of him, and this is no surprise. Livesay and his team are only a few members of the legions of people involved in film production who go about their painstaking essential work far from the public eye. Livesay is not a household name, but he is famous among people who are. His expertise, fittingly, is what can't be seen. Sound, yes, but also everything else that sound is to the human mind. The way we orient ourselves in relation to spaces, to time, to each other. The way we communicate when language fails. The way our ears know, precognitively, when the dark room has someone lurking in it, or when a stranger will be kind. He orchestrates the levels of human perception that most people either fail to examine or lack the ability to notice at all. His job is to make you feel things without ever knowing he was there. The monstrous complexity of Livesay's work, the quest to make films sound the way the world sounds, may not be immediately apparent. When a movie finishes shooting, it enters the labyrinthine world of post-production, in which the best takes are selected and spliced together into reels, roughly 20-minute segments of film that are worked on and then stitched together. Each reel goes through picture editing for such things as visual continuity and color, before being handed off to the sound supervisor, who oversees all the various elements of sound design, editing, and mixing. At the beginning of this process, editors remove the audio recordings taken during the film and break down each scene into four sonic elements: dialogue, effects, musics, and Foley, which is the term for everyday sounds such as squeaky shoes or cutlery jangling in a drawer. For every scene, each of these four elements needs to be built and then edited separately. And at WBNY, the New York production company Livesay runs with his fellow editor Paul Urmson, each gets its own dedicated editor. Then Livesay, or Urmson, takes the team's work and layers it to make scenes that sound like the world sounds. Consider the scene at the end of No Country for Old Men when Bardem's character has a car accident. After the crunch of impact, there are a few moments of what might be mistaken for stillness. The two cars rest smoking and crumpled in the middle of the suburban intersection. Nothing moves, but the soundscape is deceptively layered. There is the sound of engines hissing and crackling, which has been mixed to seem as near to the ear as the camera was to the cars. There is a mostly unnoticeable rustle of leaves in the trees, periodically so faintly that almost no one would register it consciously. There is the sound of a car rolling through an intersection a block or two over. Off camera, a dog barks somewhere far away. The faint sound of a breeze was taken from ambient sounds on a street like the one depicted in the scene. When Bardem shoves open the car door, you hear the door handle stick for a moment before it releases. There are three distinct sounds of broken glass tinkling to the pavement from the shattered window, a small handful of thunks as he falls sideways to the ground, his labored breathing, the chug of his boot heel finally connecting with the asphalt, even the pads of his fingers as they scrabble along the top of the window. None of these sounds are there because some microphone picked them up. They're there because Livesay chose them and put them there, as he did for every other sound in the film. The moment lasts about 20 seconds. No Country for Old Men is 123 minutes long. Sound mixes are notoriously stressful, in part because they come at the very end of a film's production. They are also hard on the senses. Imagine sitting in a dark room watching a movie in four-second intervals. Repeat this until the hours stretch into days, then weeks. Life becomes a series of stuttering noises stretching into eternity, punctuated only by complaints about the chunkiness or creaminess or washiness or whateverness of a fly's buzz. The impact a tiny aural cue can have on the brain's understanding of narrative is astonishing. On the third day of the mix, Livesay and Zipf were breezing through a scene of Miles dropping in on his wife France's dance rehearsal when Cheadle paused them. The scene sounded a little too dreamy. Cheadle wanted a more matter-of-fact sound. Livesay nodded and fiddled for a moment. When he replayed the scene, something small but extraordinary happened. I had watched this scene somewhere between one and two dozen times, but this time I noticed something I'd never seen before. A young woman passing behind Francis with a stack of papers in her hand. Livesay had given her footsteps. Without the footsteps, I'd somehow never seen her. Now I saw her, and her presence, along with a few other tweaks by Livesay, suggested bustling in the room, people at work, things happening outside the eye contact forged between Miles and Francis. I didn't exactly hear the difference. I just saw the scene differently. In order for that edit to be possible, Livesay needed the footsteps of that young woman close at hand. He needed not just any footsteps, but ones that sounded like they were made by low heel of roughly the sort that women would wear in the mid-1970s, crossing a wooden stage. This kind of noise, one that requires precision, but that is intended to blend into the background, is called Foley. For Jack Foley, who first came up with a process for adding quotidian noises such as footsteps to films in the 1920s. When Livesay reached for that girl's footsteps, he wasn't going back into some old library. He was reaching into the library of Foley designed and created specifically for Cheadle's film. The Foley House, also known informally at his studio as the Sound Castle, where these sounds are made, is in New Jersey, just over the George Washington Bridge from Manhattan. It is not so much a castle as a warehouse, crammed with more stuff than can be adequately described here. Marco Costanzo, the antic Foley artist who works there, takes evident joy in giving tours of the soundstage and the treasures he stores there. A bin full of Zippo lighters, a bunch of swords, from when we did Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, barrels, bicycles, baby carriages, one area devoted to different kinds of indoor flooring, and another devoted to outdoor ground cover, a pool. We built it to do the sounds for the raft in Life of Pi. A child's easy bake oven. I beg people not to take things to the dump, but to bring them to me instead, says Costanzo, grinning and spreading his arms wide. Costanzo's job is to replicate every sound that might reasonably be produced in film, while his colleague, engineer George Lara, directs and records. Lara, tucked into a sound booth, announces the cue to Costanzo, skin on cloth, and pulls up the clip for him. Costanzo watches, wants to rehearse, positions his two microphones to approximate the distance and reverb needed, and then does it for real, eyes locked on the screen. They work up from the easy things like hand on hair, for which Costanzo, bald as an egg, has a menagerie of wigs, to the harder cues, the sound of a tiger's feet scraping wood or the sickening thump-clunk of gallows releasing. "You make every single sound?" I asked Costanzo. "He performs it," Lara gently corrected me. Costanzo changes into shorts before recordings to ensure that the microphones won't pick up the sound of trouser hem rubbing against his shoes. On the morning I visited, he changed while watching his first cue, a woman knitting. He carefully selected two pieces of wood from his collection, tapping them once or twice to get the right sound, and then executed the taps again in time with gusto for the recording. If sound editors are the secret backbone of movies, this is one of their secrets. That glorious slap Cher gave Nicolas Cage in Moonstruck before yelling, "Snap out of it"? Not Cher at all. Likely as not, that was a mustachioed man standing in his socks in a warehouse in some suburb of New Jersey. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian from UK. I'd like to read one of the obituaries this week. The Urbane Crusader Who Fought for Civil Rights, Julian Bond, 1940 to 2015. Handsome, charismatic, and always well-dressed, Julian Bond marched in the front lines of the civil rights movement and served two decades in the Georgia legislature. As a rising political star, Bond was placed in nomination for the vice presidency at the 1968 Democratic Convention, though at 28 he was 7 years too young to hold the office. At one point, he enjoyed such broad appeal that many thought him likely to become the first African-American president. But by 46, Bond was out of elected office for good, widely viewed as a study in unfulfilled promise. Bond, though, made no apologies. "I can't live up to other people's ambitions for me," he said. "I have to do what I have to do." Horace Julian Bond was raised in Oxford, Pennsylvania, where his father served as president of the nearby Lincoln University. Distinguished guests often visited the family, said the Washington Post, including Albert Einstein and prominent black figures W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson. Bond's greatest influence may have been his philosophy teacher at Morehouse University, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Bond co-founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee while at Morehouse and led anti-segregation protests at movie theaters, lunch counters, and other public facilities across the South. In 1961, he left college to serve as the SNCC's communications director, and his wit, cool personality, and good looks made him one of the best-known figures in the civil rights movement. Bond's advocacy took him to the halls of power at an early age, though not without some resistance, said CSMonitor.com. He was elected as a Democrat to the Georgia House of Representatives in 1965, but the mostly white legislature refused to seat him, citing his opposition to the Vietnam War. A legal battle raged all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled unanimously in Bond's favor, asserting that he'd been denied his freedom of speech. He would serve the next 20 years in the Georgia House and Senate. Despite his reputation for charm, Bond was not afraid to come out swinging against policies and politicians he opposed, said the Los Angeles Times. In 1971, the same year that he co-founded the Southern Poverty Law Center, Bond called Alabama Governor George Wallace the Hillbilly Hitler. In 1982, he dismissed President Reagan as an amiable incompetent who practiced a new form of social Darwinism. Yet for all his plain speaking, Bond didn't always fully connect with voters looking for an aggressive leader. He left the state Senate in 1986 after six terms to run for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, but lost a bitter contest to his old friend John Lewis, a fellow founder of the SNCC. Lewis mocked his opponent as a taillight rather than a headlight, saying that Bond, a familiar face on the national lecture circuit and on television, was most interested in stoking his own celebrity. Bond's reputation took a further knock that year when his estranged wife told police that a woman with whom her husband was dallying had cocaine connections, said the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He denied the charge, and his wife later recanted, but Bond's electoral career was finished. He spent the next decade rebuilding his reputation and in 1998 became board chairman of the NAACP, which at the time was mired in debt and seemed utterly outdated. He pushed for the organization back into the news with fiery attacks on President George W. Bush and the Iraq War, and by becoming one of the few black civil rights leaders to speak out on behalf of marriage equality for gay and lesbian people, said NYMag.com. To Bond, it was all part of his lifelong struggle for human dignity. There is no finish line to this fight, he said. You always have to keep on running. And we'll go on to the talking points page. Cuba. When will real change come? When he reopened the U.S. Embassy in Havana last week, Secretary of State John Kerry declared that Cuba's future is for Cubans to shape, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. If only this were true. Fidel and Raul Castro have maintained a stranglehold over the island for more than a half century, and that hasn't changed a whit since President Obama decided last December to recognize the Cuban regime. Life remains bleak for ordinary Cubans who still suffer soul-crushing poverty and political oppression. Kerry came to Havana calling for a genuine democracy, but then failed to invite a single dissident to watch U.S. Marines hoist the stars and stripes over the new embassy, said Andres Oppenheimer in the Miami Herald. You have to wonder, is Obama so eager to go down in history as the president who opened Cuba that he's willing to give the Castros a pass on human rights? Yes, persecution continues, but change in some form is coming, said the Charlotte, North Carolina Observer in an editorial. The Castro brothers have promised to relinquish power by 2018. Their departure won't turn the island into a free market democracy overnight. Cubans want freedom, but they believe socialism has provided good health care, schools, and other benefits. Change will be incremental, and the Obama administration has smartly decided that as Cuba evolves, the U.S. is better positioned as a neighbor than enemy. It's smart politics, too, said Casey Leans in USNews.com. A Pew Research Center poll found that 73% of Americans are in favor of reestablished relations with Cuba, including 56% of Republicans. And 72% of Americans support ending the U.S. economic embargo. That embargo is the oldest and most comprehensive set of U.S. economic sanctions against any country in the world, said William M. Liagrand in Newsday.com. It's been an abject failure. President Eisenhower imposed these sanctions to plunge Cuba into a crisis so severe that its citizens would overthrow Castro. Instead, most suffering Cubans have focused their rage against the U.S. Obama has licensed some exceptions to the embargo, but only Congress can lift it. It's time to stop punishing the Cuban people for events that happened before most of them were born. And a few short notes. Renters in the U.S. are now spending an average of 30.2% of their income on housing, according to a new report by Zillow. That's the highest percentage ever, up from 24% between 1995 and 2000. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, renters today spend an average of 49% and 47% on housing, respectively. Police officers who serve in states with high gun ownership rates, like Alabama, Alaska, and Mississippi, are three times more likely to be killed on the job than cops who serve in states with low gun ownership rates, like Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York, according to a study by the University of Illinois. In states with strong background check systems, there are 48% fewer cops killed with handguns. Oil prices are at a six-year low, dropping 3% to $42 a barrel. The American Automobile Association predicts gasoline prices may fall to $2 a gallon by New Year's. And we'll finish off with a quote from civil rights leader Howard Thurman. "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and then go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.